You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a treatment center in northern Wisconsin is helping teenagers deal with mental health problems through underwater photography. We'll find out how the program is mixing art, science, and snorkeling. First, an observation tower near Sturgeon Bay that was built when Herbert Hoover was president will soon be taken down. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources announced the decision last week to permanently close the 86-year-old tower in Pottawatomie State Park. The agency said there's significant wood decay that makes the tower unsafe and therefore it requires removal. While called the decision difficult, it said public safety is its top concern. Now, people who climbed to the top of the 75-foot tower got to see panoramic views of Sawyer Harbor, Sturgeon Bay, and Green Bay. The DNR says there are no current plans to replace the tower, but it's keeping the door open to new observation possibilities down the road. That news comes 2 years after the DNR removed Eagle Tower at Peninsula State Park near Fish Creek, again for severely decaying wood. Now that visitors won't be able to enjoy these treetop views at Pottawatomie anymore, a state lawmaker says the fallout could have chilling effects on regional tourism. Robert Coles is a Republican state senator from Green Bay. He also serves as chairman of the Natural Resources and Energy Committee. Senator Coles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Rob, for having me on the show.
Well, people might think the observation tower, it's just one part of a big park. Why are you worried about the impact this could have on tourism?
I am concerned about the observation tower, but I'm also concerned about the broader situation with maintenance of our state parks. So it's not just the tower, although I think that's part of a nice experience for families that take the day and go to one of our parks, and they go to a beach, they walk trails, they go to a restaurant. You know, they may have climbed a tower if that particular park has a tower, and the one in question here was Pottawatomie, and we're also dealing with the difficulty of replacing Eagle Tower up at Peninsula Park, but I'm making a point that these facilities, these parks, are not to be taken for granted. And I think to a certain extent, our government has done that. And because of that, there's not enough money to maintain them. Meanwhile, they are generating huge amounts of money. And let me just give you some statistics. A 2013 study of the state park system showed that we have about 14 million visitor days. In other words, each person that would visit the park, you know, somebody might visit it 10 times a year, for example. But there are huge numbers of people in our state that use our parks and huge numbers that come from out of the state using the parks. So I'm making the point, these are economic drivers. These generate lots of sales tax revenue because people go to restaurants, they stay in hotels, dot, dot, dot. So there's a huge economic impact. So we need to put enough money in these parks to make sure they continue to be the draw in our state that gives our state a wonderful tourism edge.
And that goes back to a change a few years back in how state parks were funded. The state legislature, your colleagues, moved it to, and the governor moved it to, a self-funding model, the idea that the parks can generate the revenue they need to sustain themselves. And you're saying these towers are one, at least, symbol that that's not happening?
I would say that that's pretty true. Now, back in November, we passed a bill with Representative Tussler and Representative Kitchens and myself, all legislators that care a lot about state parks. We passed a $4.5 million bill to fix water systems. Now, that was some stewardship money that we put into our state parks. But that GPR chunk that you mentioned that was taken out, that needs to be brought back in. I would argue, and I'm positive that I'm right about this, the parks are generating far more money to our state treasury, and we need to take some of that money to make sure they're maintained enough so we keep the visitor base growing. If we don't, I think that there will be a subtle, it wouldn't be immediate. You know, for example, somebody goes to Pottawatomie, which triggered, you know, Pottawatomie Park, which triggered, are they going to say, well, I'm not going to Pottawatomie because we don't have a tower? But I'm saying if there's a gradual erosion of the amenities, of the things that make it a complete experience, we could have an erosion of the sales tax money coming to the state and a degradation of the experience that sort of makes Wisconsin a nifty place to live.
Are you calling on your colleagues to say, let's take the next budget, I know that's a way off, put that GPR, that general purpose revenue, back into the state park system?
Yeah, and I don't know, Rob, if that's, you know, the right number. But I believe that we need to have buildings that are in need of fixing fixed. We need to have excellent beaches for families to bring the kids and keep them occupied in the summertime, especially. The towers, nice trail, the whole experience, and have them staffed. So I think that that's also an issue with the state parks. So our state parks are clearly an economic driver, and I want to make sure that it stays that way. So, you know, we keep generating sales tax monies at an excellent level and providing a great experience for the families of the state to get away and do something at a reasonable cost.
Talking to State Senator Robert Coles from Green Bay about state park funding as symbolized in the removal and non-replacement of a couple of observation towers in parks in his part of the state. Senator Coles, do you get a sense from your Republican colleagues, currently the majority in the legislature, that, hey, maybe this change was a mistake, that they agree with you and are thinking about changing things back?
I've already talked to several colleagues, and we'll have to see how this plays out. I've already spoke to the DNR. There will be a public hearing on the removal of the tower sometime in the next few weeks, somewhere in northeast Wisconsin. So, I mean, I'm going to keep working on it. I can't guarantee that I will win on this thing, but I believe strongly that well-maintained parks that have the complete experience for families is a really good thing for the state and for the economy of the state. So I'll keep working with my colleagues to try to do this. We were successful, you know, back in November, and the governor signed the bill to fix a bunch of water systems that were getting to the point where they may not have been necessarily dangerous, but we were putting more money into them to fix them every year. So we just needed to put new water systems, new toilets, and other water systems in our parks. So that, we need to keep doing that because there's still more to be done there. So I'm trying to watch this. I just have a strong feeling about it going back to my youth when I first went to parks, and I was fascinated by the whole experience, and I continue to go to our state parks today as a way to sort of get away from things and put life in perspective. So I believe many, many people do that with their families, and I'd like to keep it that way for as long as we can.
Was this a concern you had when this change was made to make the state parks budgetarily self-sustaining, to take them out of the general revenue budget?
Yeah, I was concerned about it then. I did vote against that budget. It wasn't just that issue. There were a number of issues. But they don't generate enough money. Clearly, they don't generate enough money to take care of all the needs. Now, could they in theory, but if you jacked up the price of admission, but then you're making it very hard for the middle class to enjoy the parks. We don't want to do that. So there has to be a balance between the general purpose revenue and then the fee revenue that's being generated all the time by our parks.
And are you hopeful one way or another that you're going to see these observation towers get replaced sometime in the near future?
Well, I am optimistic, and I do think that the state should pay that. We shouldn't be having fundraisers for a state facility. I think that it would be very difficult to get that tower back up the way it was because of the Americans with Disabilities Act. You've got that issue, and that's one of the dilemmas we're facing with Eagle Tower up in Ephraim area. So I do think that there should be another viewing station. The question is, exactly how do we do it? That particular site where the Pottawatomie Tower is right currently is the highest point in the park. That's where I would say the next one should be. It may not be as high, and it may be more expensive, but I think our goal should be to try to replace that as economical and as quickly as possible to keep the experience in that park and other parks that are facing the different maintenance problems.
Senator Coles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Robert Coles is a Republican state senator from Green Bay. We talked with him about DNR funding related to the DNR's decision to tear down and not replace an 86-year-old observation tower at Pottawatomie State Park. Both photography and underwater diving and snorkeling are hobbies for a lot of people, but a treatment center in northern Wisconsin is bringing the two together as a form of therapy. For about 5 years, the Under the Surface program at Northwest Passage in Webster has been working with teenagers who are dealing with mental or emotional health challenges by training them in aquatic photography. Their pictures have been published and even shown in public galleries. By mixing art and science, the program aims to give kids confidence and an appreciation for the state's ecosystems. Ian Carl is the Experiential Program Coordinator at Northwest Passage. Ian, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rob.
And Tobin LaFrancois is an aquatic biologist and adjunct professor at Northland College in Ashland. Tobin, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, Tobin, how did this idea come about, using underwater photography as a kind of therapy?
Well, you know, I think that Ian should talk a little bit about Northwest Passage to make sense of all this, but I'd seen their work and what they were able to do with it, and it just clicked for me in terms of being an underwater research scientist, you know, working underwater, seeing the things I'd seen and realizing people just don't get exposed to that very often. And that, you know, the Wisconsinites should see what's in their water and be a really fun way to show what's going on down there and that it's beautiful right in our own backyard.
And Ian, talk a little bit about Northwest Passage and what some of the things are that the teens are dealing with when they come there.
Yeah, well, Northwest Passage was, you know, we're actually celebrating our 40th year right now. We were founded in 1978 with the goal of, our central tenet was to get kids closer to nature and recognizing the fact that nature was a powerful element in mental health treatment. So the kids that come to us, they're dealing with issues of anxiety, depression, attention deficit issues, significant mental health issues. A lot of the kids we work with are dealing with significant crisis in their lives. And when they come to us, we have a whole team of direct care counselors, teachers, case managers, therapists, and psychologists. That those are really the folks that make the work that Tobin and I get to do really possible. But they build the foundation and for the work that we do out in the field.
And Tobin, now take us out into the water. You're there, you're with this group of teens from Northwest Passage, and what do you do?
Well, we get them all suited up, first of all, in 7-millimeter wetsuits, which makes the experience really safe, even for kids who sometimes haven't swam before because they float. So usually I get to a site first and check it out for safety, and they're all sites that Ian and I have spent a lot of time in, so we know the areas well, along with St. Croix and Amicaga and Lake Superior. And the kids show up and we go over the safety of the day. We have a nice, we run it like an actual working dive. It's for professional divers, and we have a meeting about what today is going to be like, what the safety requirements are. And they get suited up and start exploring, and we let them explore where they will with a mask and a snorkel and fins. It's not required. You can actually get great photographs in, you know, ankle-deep water if you're crawling around in it. So some kids prefer that. And the kids explore for probably about 2 or 3 hours. Then we have a break and lunch and then usually go back in the water again. And then end the day with a conversation about what they found. They share their photos, and we talk about all the neat things that kind of leads into a lot of the science and history of the area.
Ian, I've only snorkeled a little in my life, and sometimes I think of, oh, you go out in the ocean and find this mysterious different world under the water. We've got some pretty interesting underwater scenery here in Wisconsin, it turns out.
Yeah, we really do. It's pretty fascinating to see what's in there. And you know, I come from a strong biology background as well, and didn't realize a lot of what we found, what we've discovered with the kids, until I was out there discovering with the kids. You know, things from freshwater sponges to all the variety of fish species and the variety of mussels that we have in the rivers and lakes up here. It really is quite fascinating. So the learning opportunities through discovery, through this idea of inquiry-based learning or exploration before learning, is really, really powerful when we get kids in the water and get a chance to see what's in there.
And Tobin, you said somewhere once that sometimes these kids, they're getting in there and they're capturing the picture of a particular creature or something that you haven't been able to get a picture that good yourself.
Yeah, it's amazing to me after working with mussels for many years and seeing mantle displays where they lure in fish to put the young in the fish gills. It's an exciting life cycle. You know, I've seen it happen. I've tried to get pictures of it. The kids have a certain patience and a certain eye, and they learn so quickly how to use the equipment we provide that the pictures they get, and you can look at those in the book we put out, are just better than anything that I've ever been able to get. So it's really amazing what they're capable of and what they can produce, and it gives us a chance to show the public, you know, what's down there and why people are interested in it, what scientists are kind of looking for when they talk about these things.
We're talking to Tobin LaFrancois from Northland College. He's an aquatic biologist. Also with us, Ian Carl, Experiential Program Coordinator at Northwest Passage. Ian, let's get into the therapeutic side of this. What are teens getting out of this? What's kind of the before and after they start doing this underwater photography?
You know, that's a great question. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of the kids that come to our program are dealing with issues of anxiety and depression and attention deficit issues. And a lot of these things have created challenges for them in their home settings and their school settings. And the type of or the approach we take to this program directly addresses those things. Those have been associated with those diagnoses have been associated in the past with a lack of contact with nature, as a matter of fact. So getting them in contact with nature is a therapeutic process for them. And there's broadly held ideas out there that are supported by research that contact with nature is genuinely beneficial for us, both physically and mentally. There's a recent study that came out of Japan. There's this idea of forest bathing that may have been, it's been in the news a bit lately. But it supports the idea that contact with nature actually lowers our pulse rate, our blood pressure, and actually cuts down on, diminishes the cortisol levels in our blood, which is a stress hormone. And we see it when we get kids in the water. They go from an excited or anxious or nervous state to one of calm and focus and become truly engaged in what they're doing. And then, as Tobin mentioned, we add the mask and the snorkel and the camera to that, and it even more focuses their attention, and it also cuts down on the noise, both the literal noise and the kind of figurative noise of the world around them, and brings them into sharp focus for that time that we're in the water. And we'll see a kid who might not last 5 minutes in a typical classroom spend an hour or more trying to focusing and trying to get that perfect photo of a mussel or a fish, and it really is magical.
Tobin, I watched just a short video, and I got to say, I felt more calm just watching that. Is there something, we've talked on the show actually about the case that there's something particularly therapeutic about being in or near a body of water, and you're doing this a lot. Do you feel that?
Yeah, and we discovered that, you know, when we started this program, there's this whole Blue Mind movement started by Wallace Nichols to collect the various data and research about the neuropsychological effects of being in water. And there's a lot of examples of it. You know, we have colleagues out west working with veterans, taking them surfing and studying the hormone levels in the blood, and also psychological response variables that are positively affected by being in the water. And there's, you know, a physiological basis to this, and it's outside my research area, but you can observe it happen. As Ian said, when you have a van full of problems get out, and then in 15 minutes in the water, and it's people have come up, you know, Park Service people I work with have come up and said, "Oh, Tobin, you got graduate students?" No. You know, these are kids that are normally not very good in the classroom, and this is the level of concentration they're capable of. And I think that's an important point, is that all the things that they're getting at Passage are really amazing and setting them up for success and showing people what these kids are really capable of.
And part of that, Ian, is, as I mentioned earlier, they end up doing a photo exhibit. Talk about that as part of the effort of what Tobin just said, demonstrating what they're capable of.
No, absolutely. The the therapeutic process in the water is one thing, and then the follow-through on that is really vital as well. Through this program, kids get a chance to realize and discover a talent they didn't know they had before, and that's a really powerful process. And then we take those photos and we work with them to refine them and select their bests and get them gallery ready, so to speak. And we've had their photos on display across the state and actually, frankly, across the nation. Cable Natural History Museum, state capitals, and our own gallery here in Webster, Wisconsin, where we have their photos on display as well. And that process, when you have a group of kids at a photo reception who haven't necessarily gotten the best attention for something positive they've done before, is extremely powerful. When they have a crowd of people applauding them and shaking their hands and saying, "Great work! You're quite talented. You know, you're amazing, great, wonderful photography," is really a strength building experience for them.
What's it like for you, Tobin, as a, you know, aquatic biologist, something that you could have done your whole career, just kind of going out into the water with by yourself or with grad students, as you just mentioned. What is it like to do this and share your work with these kids and see it make a difference in their lives?
Oh, it's extremely powerful. I can't say enough about it. You know, I thought I was weird. You know, when I was 16, you know, going to Lake Superior the first time on a science trip with my biology teacher, it just blew me away, and I thought I was weird. Like, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I couldn't stop, you know, wanting to be in the water. And I thought, oh, it's just me. You know, I'm just kind of nutty that way. And then a lot of the people I work with feel the same way. And then to find out that there's just something pretty universal about getting in the water and learning these techniques and just enjoying the day and discovering things together. The fact that it's helping not just a few kids, but pretty much, you know, all the kids that enter the program in one way or another find a way to make the water their place and show us new things about it. It's really revitalized my love for being in the water and for just, you know, the settings we have in Wisconsin, the very unique and pristine environment.
It's a great place to leave it. Tobin, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
And Ian, glad you could be with us too.
Thanks so much for having us.
We've been talking to Ian Carl and Tobin LaFrancois. They're part of the Under the Surface program at Northwest Passage in Webster. Ian's the Experiential Program Coordinator at Northwest Passage. Tobin is an aquatic biologist and adjunct professor at Northland College in Ashland. They use underwater photography as an educational and therapeutic tool for teenagers dealing with mental and emotional health challenges. Now, after House Speaker Paul Ryan's announcement yesterday that he will not seek re-election to Congress, there's a lot of talk about who might run for his congressional seat. Among Republicans, there are several state lawmakers in Ryan's district, including Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who are seen as possible candidates. Before Ryan made his announcement, two Republicans are already planning to run, as well as two Democrats. One person who won't be making a bid is former White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, who ruled out the possibility on WISN radio in Milwaukee this morning.
It's not a good time, and not to mention, I just took a great job with Michael Best and Friedrich in Milwaukee, the firm that I was with for many, many years before all of this started, and it's going great. And, you know, being a little separated from the daily political grind has been unbelievable. And so the answer is no.
Candidates can begin filing nomination papers this Sunday with the deadline set for June 1st. So who's in the best position to run for the seat? How much of a chance do Democrats have to take this away from Republicans? And what is Paul Ryan's legacy in Congress, including his tenure as House Speaker? Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, first off, Susan, what was your reaction to Speaker Ryan saying he's done, he's not going to run again this year?
Well, there had been speculation for a few months that he, in fact, was going to retire, so I wasn't completely taken by surprise.
And Ryan's announcement comes about 6 weeks before the filing deadline here. A lot of the election handicappers have moved this seat one notch toward the Democrats. The crystal ball changed the race from likely Republican to toss-up. The Cook Political Report moved it from solid Republican to leans Republican. Do you think Ryan getting out of this race does make that much of a difference for a Democrat's chances?
I think so. If you look at what the two most recent presidential elections, for example, Trump won the district 53-42, and Romney carried it in 2012, 52-47, and that was with Ryan as his running mate. So I think that if you consider Paul Ryan not being on the ballot, that would definitely give the Democrats a better shot. And added on top of that, we keep hearing about this blue wave and the Democrats having a good year in 2018. So I think that Democrats were quite happy to hear the news yesterday.
I want to look at candidates on both sides of the race here. We have two Democrats running, not really your traditional types of candidates, Ironworker Randy Bryce, a.k.a. Iron Stash online, and Janesville teacher Kathy Myers. Randy Bryce getting a lot of national attention. I wonder if a lot of more politically experienced people had known Paul Ryan wasn't going to run, they might have gotten into the race.
Oh, I think there's no doubt about that. And I think that what we've seen with Randy Bryce in particular is that he's become a bit of a darling of the left liberal Democratic party, even outside of Wisconsin. So he's raised an enormous amount of money for a challenger to have raised by this point in the campaign. And I think that a lot of Democrats who otherwise might have considered running saw that this was a seat that Speaker Ryan, had he not decided to retire, would have retained.
And on the Republican side, we had two Republicans who said they were going to challenge Ryan in a primary. Paul Nehlen, who lost Ryan by 68 points a couple years ago. Republicans do not want him as a candidate, at least the official party. Very controversial, anti-Semitic references on his Twitter feed, for example. And Nick Pulse, an Army veteran from Lake Geneva without a lot of political background. Do you expect to see a lot of Republicans now who wouldn't have thought of running against Paul Ryan now coming out of the woodwork to race for this seat?
I think that there were quite a few Republicans who had heard the same rumors or read the same rumors that I did and perhaps had been mulling in their mind if, in fact, Speaker Ryan did decide to retire, that they would likely run. And I think that there's quite a few people right now who are assessing whether or not making a run is a good idea for them.
Talking to Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. But what happens next after Speaker Paul Ryan announced that he's not running for re-election? And let's turn to this now, looking back at his career in Congress. 20 years he'll have been in there. He led the House Ways and Means Committee, which seemed like what he really wanted to do, and then, on all appearances at least, reluctantly became House Speaker. Can you talk about his rise in the Republican House ranks, Susan?
Sure. So as you mentioned, he's been in Congress about 20 years, and his focus has been, and I would say consistently throughout his time, on two main things, I would say, tax reform and entitlement reform. And so his committee assignments, as he gained seniority in the House, went in that direction. So he had been chair of the Budget Committee, and then, as you mentioned, chair of the Ways and Means Committee. And I genuinely believe when he says that he did not want to be Speaker, that he's being honest about that. He was very reluctant when John Boehner decided to leave to take on the role of Speaker, but he was really the only person that the Republican caucus could gather around and put forward in that regard. So he somewhat reluctantly took on the role of Speaker in 2015.
Understandably reluctant, it seems to me that House Speaker is a really bad job to get because you're the other side hates you and you're a target of their negative ads and their attacks. Your own side, a lot of people there are going to hate you if they don't think you're advancing their agenda strongly enough. If there's disputes within your party, you're in the middle of that. This is a rough job.
Definitely, and I think that it's become rougher over the past two decades or so, I would argue, as what we would call regular order has gone away. And so policymaking tends to be, budget making in particular, tends to be through continuing resolution and omnibus bills, and not the way that those of us who teach this stuff teach how it's supposed to happen. And so in that role, particularly being Speaker, it makes it even more difficult because you're responsible for corralling your members to vote for things that perhaps they didn't have a hand in shaping or they're feeling like they've been left out of the process. So I think it's even more difficult now than it would have been, say, 20, 30 years ago.
Shortly after Donald Trump was sworn in as president, Ryan came out with a pretty ambitious agenda with Republican control of both houses and now the White House. Here he is on Fox laying out his plan back then.
Inside the 200-day window is the regulatory reforms we talked about. It's the repeal and replace Obamacare. It's the budget. It's the rebuilding of our military. It's tax reform. Those are the things that we're working on. And infrastructure. Those are the things we're working on.
So some of that happened. The tax reform, definitely. The budget keeps getting bounced along. Repeal and replace Obamacare did not happen. Infrastructure is still in the works. And he was a deficit hawk in the past. Deficits appear to be on the rise again. How do you evaluate how Paul Ryan and his fellow congressional Republicans met those goals?
Well, if we're looking at just since President Trump took office and then the Republicans controlled both houses of Congress and the presidency, I think that, you know, as you went through your list, the one thing that we could sort of check off is tax reform. And I would argue that the tax reform bill that was passed that is going to do a lot to increase the national debt is perhaps not what Speaker Ryan had in mind when he joined Congress and began talking about tax reform. So I think the entire Republican Party bears responsibility there for what the tax reform bill has done and will do moving forward to the national debt.
We asked about Paul Ryan on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Deborah sees a man with integrity who can no longer work with the loose cannon in the White House. Deborah says she's happy for Paul Ryan's wife and children. Let's talk about that. Speaker Ryan and President Trump, in many ways, very different visions of what it meant to be a conservative and a Republican.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that was part of the help prod the decision making in that regard. It has to be terribly difficult to work with President Trump from the perspective of he changes his mind quite a bit, as we know, and it's difficult to negotiate with him. And so if you're the Speaker of the House, you need to be able to speak to the president and make agreements and negotiations that then you can take back to your members and let them know that this is where what page the president is on and how you plan to move forward. And oftentimes you'd have those meetings take place at the White House, and I'm assuming the speaker would go back preparing to report back to his caucus, and then a tweet will come out from the president that says the opposite of what the speaker was going to report back. So that has to be a terribly frustrating environment to work in.
We're talking to UW-Whitewater political scientist Susan Johnson about Paul Ryan's announcement that he's not going to run again for Congress. What happens next in that congressional seat? What is Paul Ryan's legacy as a congressman, as a speaker of the House? You can join in at 800-642-1234 on those topics. If you are in this district, what are you watching for in this race? If you're a Republican in that district, who do you hope gets into that race? If you're a Democrat, do you think you have a shot at joining the theoretical blue wave that's on the way and flipping that seat? And how would you describe Paul Ryan's legacy as a leader in the House, as House Speaker? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our discussion of outgoing House Speaker Paul Ryan. Susan Johnson stays with us. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, just outside of Ryan's first congressional district in Wisconsin. You can join in with your thoughts on Ryan's legacy, where you think he succeeded or failed, at 800-642-1234. Was he an effective or ineffective Speaker of the House, and why? And if you're in that district in particular, Democrat, Republican, or somewhere in between or outside that scale, what are you looking for? What are you hoping for when it comes to your next congressional representative? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. To your calls now, Pat is with us in Mequon. Pat, hi.
Hi. I would just like to say I agree with that caller. We have not heard the end of Paul Ryan. I think he is very ambitious, but I also think he retired because here in Wisconsin he's not very popular, and there's being a lot of money spent so he doesn't get voted in again. And, you know, Paul Ryan is a guy who his dad died at 16, and he got to where he is through college and everything on Social Security. But yet he doesn't want anybody else to have those benefits. I really don't understand that.
Pat, thanks for the call. A couple points there. Let's start with the political future. We also heard from Steven on Facebook who says Paul Ryan will come back riding a white horse, he says, as a replacement for Trump and to save the Republican Party in the country in 2020. So, Susan, only Paul Ryan knows the answer to this. Maybe Paul Ryan doesn't know the answer to this yet, but talk about the possible political future for him.
Well, yesterday in his press conference, he said that he had no interest in ever running for political office again. That's generally, people say that, but they don't necessarily always mean it, and I obviously cannot read his mind. I would not be surprised if at some point down the road he did decide to return to politics, but who knows? I don't see 2020 as being a likely reemergence for Paul Ryan. I genuinely don't. I believe him when he says that he wants to spend more time with his family. Oftentimes we laugh when people say that, but I believe that if we think back to when he reluctantly took on the role of Speaker, the concerns about his young children and having his wife all back in Janesville was a real legitimate concern for him. So, and he joked about maybe wanting to be ambassador to Ireland in his 60s. So I would say for now, we might see him join a think tank or something and work in that capacity, or a visiting professorship maybe, doing some teaching. But I think I don't see him reemerging in a political role in the foreseeable future.
And Pat also raised the issue of so-called entitlement reform, a goal of Congressman Ryan's to change things like Social Security and Medicare, concerns among a lot of people that that meant reducing benefits. Pat, critical of him as many others are. Talk about that as a signature issue.
Well, like I said, that was one of the two things that he really moved on throughout his career in Congress, and that is one where I think we're not going to see, obviously, any change between now and when he leaves office. And he's been talking about entitlement reform, and I think, as Pat mentioned, and you said others as well, have this concern that entitlement reform meant reducing entitlements to people, and so that obviously raises a lot of concerns. But when politicians talk about doing that, particularly when you're talking about Social Security and to a certain degree Medicare, we call those the third rail of politics, because people don't like to touch those because they really raise the ire of a lot of the electorate.
Thanks for the call, Pat. We'll go next to Max on the line in Twin Lakes. Max, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, you asked for some feedback on Paul Ryan's legacy, and what I'd like to comment is that I think it's an unfortunate legacy. Under Paul Ryan's tenure, we've seen the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. The economy, we'll see how it performs. My point is that I feel he hasn't even lived up to his self-proclaimed principles. He called for fiscal restraint over the years, but he's leaving us with trillion-dollar budget deficits for years to come. And you just talked about entitlements, so I won't go over that. I'll just take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Max, thanks for the call. Any comments, Susan?
Well, I mean, I would say to reiterate this idea of people's concerns about entitlement reform, and we've already talked about the issue of the debt and some of the concerns there. So I think that there's a lot of people on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, who are concerned about the deficit and the growing national debt. And so he's taken criticism not just from Democrats, but also from quite a few Republicans who have those same concerns.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Wayne in Mequonago. Wayne, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My statement is, Paul Ryan is an American. He puts his pants on one leg at a time, and he, being a Speaker of the House like Boehner, I can understand why Speaker Boehner retired. You know, the stress level, but he has his points, and then he's got his party points, and he's got the, well, both sides, and he's got to play the aisle for compromise, to get anything through, get anything established. But the point is, he realized that it's going nowhere, and he is a family man, and he can look at half the Republicans are getting out. Gowdy's leaving. A lot of Republicans are leaving. Why is that? Because the establishment and the people are saying this, this, and this. And I remember people saying the same thing about the last Speaker of the House and the last president. So where does it come to a point that we become America again and we don't have these issues like sanctuary cities and, you know, we've got major problems locally?
Wayne, I'm going to jump in a lot there. So Wayne, seeing this kind of partisan grind, this divisive grind, knocking out not just people like Paul Ryan and John Boehner, but other people from Congress, Susan.
Right. So Paul Ryan is just one of a long list of Republicans. I think at last count it's 38 who have decided that they're not seeking re-election in the House of Representatives. And I think something like 25 of them are retiring from politics altogether, not trying to seek higher office or something like that. So we're seeing within the Republican Party a lot of people, more so than what you normally expect in an election cycle, who have decided to move on and not run for re-election. And we're seeing a bit of that on the Democratic side, but we're clearly seeing more of that frustration on the Republican side.
Thanks for the call, Wayne. We're talking to Susan Johnson, political scientist at UW-Whitewater, looking at the upcoming departure of Paul Ryan from Congress. He's not running for re-election, as we've been hearing, what that means for the future, and looking a little bit at his legacy in Congress. Let's take another caller now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Do you remember the old days when Mr. Ryan was there with Eric Cantor and he was one of the GOP's quote-unquote young guns and he was going to change Congress and all of this? How much of Paul Ryan is just facade and how much is substance, I think? He was always touted as this great policy wonk, but his mathematics seemed to never agree with itself. And for me, Paul Ryan's image will always be Paul Ryan during the Romney campaign in the closed soup kitchen, trying to desperately show a human face.
Tom, thanks for the call. Tom accusing Paul Ryan of being more, I guess, style than substance, Susan.
Well, you know, we've heard that more and more frequently from people, other commentators and columnists who look at Paul Ryan and have watched his career over time, have said that this idea of him being this policy wonk is more fiction than fact. But I would bring it back to this idea that he has moved forward on some pretty substantive policy issues, or hope to move forward on some pretty substantive policy issues. And I don't know him, so I hate to make those kinds of judgments about him.
Thanks for the call. In our last minute or two, Susan, you mentioned you don't see a big push on entitlement reform in Paul Ryan's last, 10 months or so as Speaker. What do you see maybe being accomplished now, between now and the time this Congress comes to a wrap?
You know, I honestly don't see much, and I don't attribute that to Speaker Ryan deciding to retire. I just think that we get into election mode anyway, and the fact that we're in a particularly contentious election period with a president who isn't necessarily getting along with his party, and this idea of not having many shared goals, I think that we were already going to be in a bit of a rut, and I think that this might add a little bit to it, but I don't know that this is actually making a huge difference.
We'll leave it there for now. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Susan Johnson. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. We talked with her about House Speaker Paul Ryan's legacy and the race to succeed him in Wisconsin's first congressional district. Still time for you to weigh in on, well, both of those issues, Paul Ryan's legacy in Congress and who succeeds him now, and what this potential blue wave might mean for that district and Democrats' chances to flip it from a Republican seat. You can share your thoughts, tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can join the conversation over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a lot of attention has been given lately to the health risks posed by lead pipes. Flint, Michigan, sure, Milwaukee too, but Milwaukee leaders are working to make sure that lead paint isn't overlooked as a threat. We're going to talk to a public health expert about the risks of lead contamination, where it's coming from, and the kind of impact it can have, especially when kids are exposed to it. Country music's biggest stars will gather in Las Vegas Sunday for the 2018 American Country Music Awards. We'll check out some of the people nominated, the songs nominated, and find out who's favored to win. Plus, on this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll talk with a chef who combines Mexican cooking roots with Southern-style dishes in the kitchen. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.